From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, our continuing coverage of the 2020 election with Philadelphia-based political analyst Professor Tony Montero. We spoke with him via Skype from Philadelphia on Thursday. Well, it appears that the traveling circus is once again changing membership. It looks like we're about to lose Biden and all the entertainment value that goes with having him around. But Mikey Bloomberg, little Mike, as Trump calls him, he's come out swinging, saying that to Trump, you know, all your friends in New York make fun of you behind your back. It's just going to get more and more interesting going forward.
I think the first two primaries are showing us some things, although not everything, about the candidates, about the people who are voting, and about the future of the Democratic Party. You know, I'm a little concerned. I don't think Bernie is exciting the working class and the lower middle classes this time around as he did in 2016. Now, why that is the case, we can talk about it, but I think it is the case. The other thing is that the Democratic Party changing the rules so Bloomberg can now be in debates cannot leave Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and Julio Castro feeling too happy, right? Because it seems as though the Democratic Party leadership are bending to money rather than principle, and it comes off as highly racist, given that the three who those three who had to exit with a considerable amount of promise, had they been given the opportunity, were all people of color, two black people and one Mexican-American.
Yeah, and there's two others banished like that, too. One was Mike Gravel, the other is Tulsi Gabbard, and they both have in common that they've questioned the foreign policy consensus.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Now, Tulsi is still in it, but these three are not. And they are not because of the way the rules were set up, which seem to have favored white candidates with money over non-white candidates without the same amount of money, let us say. But what I want to get at is that the contradictions within the Democratic Party seem to be very intense, if not antagonistic, making it more difficult to unite the party even after the convention in July in Milwaukee. Now, what I'm also getting at is that this obsession with defeating Trump at any cost has taken the party further away from the interests and needs of working people. And so that means, if I'm reading this right, that they cannot beat Trump unless they come forward with a program that is not just Medicare for all, but a total program that addresses the issues of the working class, and in particular, the black working class, which will be strategic in whatever happens in November. So that's the way I'm looking at it right now. We could say a little bit more about Bernie Sanders and socialism. Well, let me say it now. I mean, you know, it's quite unusual, and no one could have ever conceived of, let us say, Eugene V. Debs running for president in a party that is the party of war, the party of the deep state, the party of the intelligence services. It does not seem to make sense. You could say, I guess you can say, well, at the same time, it's the party of most working people, of most black people, of most Latinos, and so on. Maybe you can say that, but increasingly, the party since 2016 has been defined more and more as the party of war. Certainly, Hillary Clinton as the nominee was precisely that. I don't think that's a good omen for the party going forward to November. I don't think it's a good omen for Bernie Sanders.
You know, all right, so just this last part I want to work a little bit. Mm-hmm. The party of war. Yeah. And the party of, I forgot what the second thing was.
Intelligence services.
Right, the intelligence services. And then the third, of course, which we can't leave unsaid, is the party of neoliberal economics. Which is,
absolutely.
You know, and so if you look at the, you know, what's a cause, what's an effect, you know, in all of this, you have, in essence, an economic system that has, you know, these tools available to sustain itself. The purposes of the war making, you know, capacity and the purposes of the wars conducted essentially is to serve the interests of the class interests, mm-hmm. of the transnational bourgeoisie, to be able to extract, mm-hmm. value from working people and the planet wherever they like, whenever they like. That's the function it serves. The intelligence agencies serve the same function, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though the two apparatus, the one on each side of that divide, may have competing claims against each other. You know, that's their point within the service of class interests, is to serve the interests of the transnational bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. And so I don't understand how you would suddenly translate out of that the head, you know, the master of those tools, and hand it over to socialist economics, substituting socialist economics for neoliberal economics, and substituting the class, basically, of working people. They will suddenly begin blowing themselves up and spying on themselves in order to have health care. Is that the logic of it?
No, it can't work. I mean, that's why I began with the whole thing that Bernie is not exciting the working class this time around, at least in the first two primaries, or caucus and primary, as he did in 2016. The Culinary Workers Union in Nevada is not endorsing anybody, you know? So unless and until there is a working class uprising that would take over the Democratic Party, maybe something like Corbyn did with the Labour Party in England, if that doesn't happen, no matter who is at the top of the party in terms of the presidential candidate, the party will still be in the clutches of the Pentagon, the generals, and the intelligence services, along with the biggest banks and so on. It, you know, what I'm trying to say, Don, this party is not a good fit for Bernie Sanders, and I want to add, the Democratic Socialist, which is another way of saying he's a left liberal. But this party doesn't fit him. And going forward, the antagonisms between, let us say, Bernie and the so-called moderate wing of the party, not to mention Bernie and possibly Bloomberg, the contradictions will only deepen and sharpen. The other conclusion at this point that we can draw from this is that, as it looks now, given the state of the Democratic Party, Trump will be reelected.
And what does that mean, given all these other things? That's a whole other question.
Well, that's a whole other question. But given that the Democratic Party is the unity that they might have is only on the basis of defeating Trump, which I don't think is strong enough to win. In other words, they can't win based upon a program, a political platform that is essentially beat Trump. Get Trump out of office. Right. That is not going to be a winning message. And that's the only thing that holds the Democratic Party together. Now, if they don't have that uniting them, then they split into so many pieces, so many tendencies. And every element of anger, of disappointment, of antagonism comes to the fore. I can't see Cory Booker going all out, or Kamala Harris going all out, or Julio Castro going all out for a candidate like Bloomberg. I mean, you know, for obvious reasons. I don't see the moderates, i.e. the Bidens and the Bloombergs, going all out for Bernie.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Bloomberg
it's a house divided against itself.
Yeah. Yeah, Bloomberg going out for Bernie would be a tough sell.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
All right. I mean, look, we looked at 2016 essentially as, you know, as a manifestation of a working class uprising in place.
That's right. On both sides.
Inside the Republican Party, inside the Democratic Party, and elsewhere. But inside the electoral context, you had an uprising that was manifest in each party that gave a lift to people who never would have had a chance to, you know, to win the nomination before, become almost unstoppable. That in Trump's case, he was, and in Sanders' case, he practically was. He had the entire planet arrayed against him, pretty much. And so you had that happen. You had to get frustrated in the Democratic primaries or Democratic convention, and so you never had an election to resolve that tension, you know, in a formal way. Where, first of all, you never had a campaign between Trump and Sanders. In other words, two campaigns pitching on nuance and don't know what else to two sectors of the working class that were in uprising. No, they didn't have to do that because, I mean, if you have debates, they would be talking to who they believed were the constituents of the other candidate and trying to find that bridge programs, and so you would find where some of the real divide is, as opposed to rhetorical divide, you know, in terms of policy, the things that they will say and things that they absolutely won't say, even though it looks like, you know, you could have won that. All you had to say was this, but you will never say that, will you? And so you had, that was frustrating. We've had Trump actually governing, or whatever you call it, you know, treading water over the last 4 years. Also, you know, for better or worse, true or not, many people that voted for him thinking they would get their jobs back, got their jobs back, and think it's because of him, and they're going to be a constituency that is not going to vote on we don't like Trump. Unless Sanders says, yeah, here's why you got your job back, and now I'm going to get you a big raise, some of those people will believe it, so they might vote for Sanders. A lot of them aren't going to. And so you're going to have that division in working class, even with Sanders in a working class vote. And and then, I mean, I'm just going to deal for a moment with Sanders versus Trump going out. What does it mean for the workers who are either voting or not voting looking at this? When you have somebody say socialism is the enemy, like Trump, and repeat it over and over and over, and then wants to do this this large program, that large program, et cetera, publicly funded, privately funded, whatever, with the government intervention. And then you have somebody else that everybody says is a democratic socialist saying, I, you know, believe in the capitalist system, et cetera. In other words, you have so many, all the terminology is so bastardized, you know, and it's really hard, you know. If it was clear, you wouldn't be able to see it on television because that is designed to obfuscate. But it's almost like looking at things through a kaleidoscope, trying to divine what the hell they're talking about and how these words translate into a likely policy.
Right. Well, you know, Don, if you take the word socialism seriously, and if you know the history and policies of socialist around the world, it's difficult to take Bernie Sanders seriously as a socialist.
Right.
Now, some people will say, at least he's putting the issue on the table of socialism. Well, perhaps that is maybe an unintended consequence of Bernie being in the race. I mean, there's a downside to it, because his type of socialism is really not socialism, and he is not talking about a state-controlled economy or taking over the banks or more regulation on the banks and all of the things that a socialist program would mean, including, and this is something I think very important. Well, let me say first, he would be talking about halving or cutting in half the military budget. He would start there. But a big issue is the issue of money and currency.
Right.
And it had the function of money in an economy and a society where the federal debt is the same size as the economy.
Right.
So in a certain way, if we don't redefine money and how it functions and how it will be managed, we'll never be able to get back to what is called Keynesian economics, where state intervention stimulates through state financing growth in the economy and the ultimate thing of evening out some of this vast inequality that is dragging everybody down.
Yeah, so you got to repurpose.
I think Bernie is doing socialism a kind of a disservice because it's like Disneyland socialism.
Yeah.
It's not socialism that raises the hard and real questions in opposition to the way capitalism does its business.
Yeah, for sure. Look, a couple of things. First of all, in terms of the terminology, it's all Disney socialism. The people that have called themselves socialists, the formal socialist parties and configurations around the world, subsequent to Debs's era, when you started to have the Comintern, you have communist parties around the world, and people were holding themselves out as socialists, they were already doing it in opposition to the communist movement. In other words, they were doing it in collaboration with imperialism. So their point was exactly what maybe Bernie is hinting at promising us, which is, little bit of socialism for workers in the United States, but you got to get behind our foreign policy.
Well, let me just kind of disagree with you a little bit. I mean, I would take a person like Olof Palme, Pablo Neruda, and maybe others who were not communist, but were open to, on programmatic terms, uniting with communists.
I'm not talking about them.
I'm talking about the
formal. I'm talking more like Hollande in France, Euro socialists American socialists.
Of course. British. But see, this is the problem. You literally take the socialism, as you put it, of the anti-socialist to define your socialism, or the anti-communist socialist to define the type of socialist that you are.
Right.
This is very misleading, and I think in the long run, damaging.
Look, if you look at the struggle for socialism and communism as a class struggle, in other words, if you're a Marxist, then you look at which side of the line you are on and who's on the other side of the line. On the other side of the line is the class that is in power around the world and its allies. And if you see them facing you, then you know you're on the right side of the line. Somebody else that goes over there that calls themselves a socialist or a Marxist or whatever they call themselves, if they're on the other side of the line, shoulder to shoulder with the imperialists, they are the class enemy, and that is how the battle lines break. And so a lot of these people that have called themselves socialists in the United States and, high culture of the UK and everywhere else, in the third world, in Africa and Latin America and Asia, over the years, it turns out that they were in service to imperialism. Just look at what
happened. There's no question.
So now Sanders isn't even promising that much socialism. The people that are calling him a socialist, that's mostly their politics. So that's how much cloud there is to parse through. That's all I'm saying. If you're going to try to get to the essence of the whole thing,
there's
like so much fog that it's almost impossible to see.
And I'm agreeing with you. And I'm anticipating, as we go forward, even in the primary season, if socialism is now an issue of debate, as I think it will be if Sanders is the nominee, but it falls upon our shoulders to to now define what it actually is. It is more than the Green New Deal. It is more than Medicare for all, or even free public colleges. But
right,
and we have to say what is the difference? You brought up neoliberal economics, right. You know, and if we are socialists, if we want socialist policies in the United States, we have to address how do we get out of this trap that we're in, produced by almost 50 years of neoliberal economics, Friedmanite, trickle-down, right. Supply-side economics. What do we do? And the other question is, what do socialists do with a nation that is so indebted as we are? Do we take over the banks? And no. What does that mean?
Repudiate
and how do we go about that?
Repudiate the debt and take over the banks. You know, look, the thing is, I'm only half joking. You wanted to sit for a couple hours with a couple of ledgers and I could work through some of the ideas I have on that. One of the things that people have to bear in mind is that these terms have real meanings that, you know, mm-hmm. that were carved into mm-hmm. our history.
Yes.
And when you're talking mm-hmm. about socialism, you're talking about essentially where your class stands in relations to the means of production. Are you mm-hmm. an owner or are you a worker? That is essentially mm-hmm. what that means. And so if you are not going to change your status from worker to owner, because the working class owns the means of production, then you're not changing your status at all. All you're doing is giving yourself a raise. Oh, I got health care now. That boss that beats me and sleeps with my wife and, you know, does all this other bad mm-hmm. stuff, stole my car and went to the bathroom in my favorite chair. He stole my boss, but he gave me health care.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're talking about for a revolution.
Yeah, I think that's where we're at. Now, Ocasio-Cortez made a very insightful statement when she said that you don't become a billionaire unless you robbed a lot of people.
Right.
She's right about that. But right. the next sentence has to be that you must expropriate the expropriators.
Right, let's
you
take
know?
It back.
The robbery is the expropriation
that's
of
right.
the wealth produced
that's
by working people,
right.
by the owners.
Right.
And she's and that's thievery. That's class theft.
That's right.
But the next, if you are a socialist based and rooted in class struggle, as you have mentioned, you have to at some point talk about, you don't have to use, you know, the harshest language, but taking it back.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
And short of that, I mean, it's kind of hard to see a person who doesn't think about something like that or add it in one or another way to the political discourse at a time like this. You know,
right.
It's hard to take that kind of socialism seriously.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, we've got standing, you know, on the sidelines, totally sidelined, Gravel, who was a real strong anti-war voice, never
yes.
really got his time on the stage after, I think, one debate or something.
Mm-hmm.
Tulsi has had a hard time getting a place at the podium also.
Yeah.
You know, the rules keep shifting to allow, I don't know, they seem to be able to find any excuse possible to let in some, you know, well-known figure of the establishment. But we're looking again, just to repeat it, at an uprising that's taken place on the ground among the working class. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the only solution to that is either to let it express itself or to stifle it. I mean, so
mm-hmm.
it's a decision
mm-hmm.
that, of course, the class that these people are rising in opposition to are going to try to stifle it. And that's what's mm-hmm. happened successfully thus
right.
far. Its historic task, if it has one, seems that it has to stand up and then unite with, you know, the rest of the class, which is going to be kind of tough, but there's certainly possibilities for the first mm-hmm. time in my lifetime of that actually happening in front
absolutely.
Of us. So
mm-hmm.
what do we do to encourage that? And who's the best candidate out of the Democrats to have that happen?
Well, the best candidate.
Even if it's by accident, you know, not
yeah,
their intent,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Have we ever had a best candidate? to do anything. Well, you could maybe say McGovern in 72. But in these, given the political structure, the political mechanisms in this country, we're never going to get the best candidate unless there is a profound and vast political realignment from the grassroots up, including the labor unions, communities, etc. We're not in that stage yet. And it seems, you know, it's interesting and perhaps ironic that we're further from that in 2020 than we were in 2016.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, it was palpable. And you and I took note of it. That's why we ran to Cleveland and to Philly to be a, you know, to be a part
of to watch it up close.
History. Yep. Watch it happen. Yep. Where you saw these two sides of a working class rebellion crystallizing.
Yep.
I think we're farther from that now than we were in 2016.
Well, we haven't seen those people up close again. We are what we've been stuck watching them on TV, and remember how distorted that was when we got there.
Yeah. But we don't see that. I don't think the anger is still there. Perhaps the anger is deeper, again, ironically, among Trump voters than it is in the Democratic Party. It's so watered down and fragmented that it can't, the working class and radical angry people can't get a foothold in this party at this time.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I think that the anti-Trump movement, which is the bottom line of the Democratic Party campaign for president, is doesn't have a moral standing because it began talking about impeachment the day after the guy was elected.
Right.
And, you know, how do you believe people like that? I mean, take Bernie. He keeps talking about Trump is the worst president of all time. But it seemed that you and he agreed on TPP and NAFTA. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Bernie is taking a good position on Yemen, taking a good position on Israel's moving the its capital to Jerusalem and the settlements and so. That's all good.
Right.
But are there not other points that you and Trump could have agreed with over these last 3.5 years, such as no war with Russia.
Right. Big one.
Yeah. But you know, those are questions. If you're doing politics and if you're honest about it, you take up. I think Bernie has sort of condemned himself to being a 1/3 of the Democratic Party candidate.
Right.
Because people still have questions about, and he could have won some of the Trump people away from Trump.
That's right.
If he had shown himself to be operating in good faith rather than in pure BS politics.
You know, I just want to close with this because we're out of time. That just imagine and hold this in your head till next week.
Okay.
That the first time that Trump had that phone call with Putin, or when he went to Helsinki,
right,
and when the Democrats and the intelligence agencies and the media were calling Trump treasonous for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
If Bernie Sanders had stepped out and said,
right,
"You people are all crazy. This guy, whatever else he is, he's right to do this. This is one of the most important things that could be being done right now to remove the threat of nuclear war from this world once and for all. And I, for one, totally support him on this.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as he goes forward with it, I'm standing next to him, and so should you."
Absolutely.
If he had done that,
absolutely,
where would we be now?
That's right. And where would we be now? Remember, after the Republican Party convention and as the Democratic convention was beginning, Trump reached out to Bernie,
yep,
and say, "We agree on trade. Let us try to form some kind of alliance."
Yep.
And it was possible to have what they call, and I put quotes around this, a left-right alliance,
right,
on trade and some other questions concerning,
right,
jobs and no war, no new Cold War.
Right.
But Bernie
said no.
No.
All right, so next week, we'll pick it up here.
Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, Tom.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York.
Thanks for listening.